Hey everyone, back again. Today, we're starting a three-part series on Edward Said's The Question of Palestine, which is absolutely necessary reading to understand what is happening now with Israel's violence against Palestine and Palestinians, but the history of this encounter and the history of Israel's occupation, a term they embrace, should tell you a lot about the situation just with that term, Israel's occupation, and what life is like as a Palestinian now and what it has been like for more than 100 years in Palestine. Now, before jumping into this, if you had any inclination to support me at all, instead, consider donating to the organizations I've listed in the comments section, in the description, and in the comments, because people need our help. They need our help right now. And this is one effort, at least me doing this, to raise awareness about this, because I know lots of people want to read this text because it's foundational in understanding what is going on now. And a lot of people don't have the time to. And it's just such an important theoretical and historical understanding of what's going on now. So this episode is going to cover the introduction and his preface, or in the reverse order. I'm also going to use this episode to provide key historical background to the Israel-Palestine conflict so that you know, at least have a general understanding of what's going on. Now, obviously, I cannot recount every single detail. There are people who do entire PhDs on this topic, like, I can't do that in 45 minutes. I really encourage you to just look this up yourself, and just looking it up for 5 minutes will give you a pretty good idea of the injustice that Palestinians have experienced for over 100 years. And then episode 2 is going to cover chapters 1 and 2 of the book, and episode 3 is going to cover chapters 3 and 4 of the text. Now, there are so many fantastic resources for you to go and access to understand Israel's violence against Palestinians. There's Noura Erekat's Justice for Some, that book. Also, watching the film Israelism really just changed my view on this. It didn't change it. I knew what was going on for a very long time. And I'm also going to get into the history. I'll just explain the history of my own understanding of this situation and the other episodes I've done covering this. And I'm also going to talk about the many talking points I see online and the myriad efforts to try and justify Israel's violence against Palestinians, the very common points I see online, and what I believe are the most rational, dare I say that term, rational and easy solutions to these problems that Zionists raise, at least to justify their onslaught of Palestinians and Palestinian territory. And this is all largely inspired from a certain, and you know who you are, Israeli professor who decided to reach out to me a few months ago. So to you, I know you're listening. This is for you. This is for you. And it's because of you, largely, that I'm doing this. I really rushed getting this out because of you. So pat yourself on the back. Good job. Now, right off the bat, one of the immediate charges that I see raised against people who vie for Palestinian rights is that they never cared about this before October 7th, before Hamas's violent, deadly attack on October 7th. And against that, I mean, you can go and check out the episodes I've done on A.L. Wiseman's Lethal Theory, in which he describes, and I've presented, the IDF's horrendous treatment of Palestinians, and specifically how they use Deleuze and Guattari's philosophy to conduct their own urban warfare against Palestinians by sneaking through Palestinian homes, arresting children, beating up adults, arresting them in order to go undetected. So I've done that. I've also covered Membe's necropolitics. This is all many years ago that I've done this, by the way, in which he describes the situation that Gazans live under, where Gazans within Palestine live in an open-air prison, what he calls a death world. And also, in having covered Hannah Arendt, I made it very clear Hannah Arendt's view of Zionism, Israel, and the Palestinians, where she says, and she is very clear, and herself being a very loudly spoken anti-Zionist, condemns the justification to displace in 1948 nearly a million Palestinian people, and justifying it because the Jews had just lived through the Holocaust. Now, what I also think is super important to take on, and something that'll come out throughout this, is my serious concern for the rising anti-Semitism and the problems that right now the simple equation of any challenge to Israel as being anti-Semitism, how that makes it incredibly difficult to identify the specific ways that anti-Semitism is indeed on the rise today and how we can combat it. Now, before jumping into the history of Zionism, at least kind of a general overview, this is going to get shadow banned, obviously. It's going to get shadow banned to hell. So if you happen to like what I say, if you agree, if you think it's an important resource out there, consider sharing it, maybe to reach more people. I think it'd be super important, not because of what I offer, but because of what Saeed offers, himself being a Palestinian American man who, dedicated his whole life to struggling for Palestinian rights. And I know that one of the charges against me here is that I'm not an expert in this field, and I certainly am not. But I don't think that that gets in the way of being an expert in what the value of human life is, and being an expert in what constitutes disproportionate aggression against a subjugated and oppressed people like the Palestinians. And I know that this will certainly ruffle some feathers, but in any case, it has to be said. So for those of you who aren't familiar, and at this point I'm sure many, if not most of you, have taken the time to look into this, at least somewhat. Zionism has a very long history. Zionism goes way back before Israel was established in 1948, after the Holocaust, where Jewish settlers have been steadily, from European Jewish settlers, have been steadily immigrating to Palestinian territory for about 100 years, even before World War II. Not to mention the fact that there were Jews already there in that land, like there were Jews all over the world, of course. Like, duh. Now, the history of Zionism, though, is interesting in that that area was not just assumed to be the primary location for Israel or where Israel would eventually form. The first Zionists, the first like vocal Zionists thinking about establishing a Jewish state, that is Theodor Herzl, called for a Jewish state in Palestine or in Argentina. Some are also considering in an African nation. And this is interesting because it flies in the face of the idea that there's somehow this God-given right to that land, because they were considering just anywhere that Jews could live and be free of their, like, the unbelievable historical persecution that they experienced, and this is before the Holocaust, and then having that just culminate into one of the worst horrors to ever be inflicted on any people ever, with the Nazi Germany and with the Jewish Holocaust. Now, I think it's really important to acknowledge that, to hold that to be equally true as the possibility that Jewish people who moved from Europe to Palestine could have also oppressed the Palestinian people. Both of these things can be true. The historical persecution and unbelievable violence against Jews, and then Israeli violence against Palestinians. Both of these things can be true. So to justify their immigration to Palestine, Herzl suggests that immigrating Jews would offer, in his words, the present possessors of the land enormous advantages, assume part of the public debt, build new roads for traffic. And of course here, it seems like he's referring primarily to those Jews who'd already been there. He was not referring to the Arabic population. But in any case, many of the other testimonies that we find from him, and I'm going to read them, including testimonies from so many people in the history of Israel, their view of the Arabic population within Palestine, the Palestinians there, is absolutely deplorable. And it belongs to a broader continuum of European colonialism that needs to be accounted for. And this is going to be Edward Said's, I think if I am to summarize this into a single point, it's that Zionist encroachment upon Palestinian territory belongs to that broader trajectory of European colonialism that disenfranchised people all around the world for the hundreds of years preceding real Zionist movement into Palestine. Now, what else did Herzl say about the indigenous people living there in Palestine? Well, he referred to, he suggested that the immigrating Jewish populations from Europe were necessary to fight what he called Asian barbarism. Of course, referring to the Arabic people and their automatic association with barbarism, something that very much continues to this day, but has been transformed. You know, it assumes a different kind of veneer, but it is a change in style, in the way that Arabic and Muslim people are, the way that they are treated, not only by Israel, but also by the international community, in just how widespread Islamophobia is. Now, Zionist encroachment upon Palestinian territory really came to a head following the Holocaust, when hundreds of thousands of European Jews essentially just flocked to what they wanted to be Israel in Palestinian territory. And this resulted in about 1,800,000 or so Palestinians just losing their homes, being thrown into tents and camps, all the while, and this is one of the great ironies here, justifying putting Palestinians into tents and camps because they didn't actually have any right to that land. They were, in the eyes of many of the early Zionists, they were stateless and therefore did not deserve to just like live wherever they wanted there. Which is ironic, because one of the justifications for Zionist movement into Palestinian territory was that Jews needed a state to protect themselves from the harms that would come from their being stateless, which they would then turn around and do to the Palestinians, which Hannah Arendt is just like, Arendt is just such an important figure in thinking through this, because she just describes how totalitarianism happens and how Israeli settlers just adopted many of the same strategies and deployed it against the Palestinians, or deployed them against the Palestinians, like justifying their encroachment because the Palestinians were uncivilized, undeveloped, backwards, therefore not deserving of their own land. So they could then just be viewed like ants, just kicked out of their land, it doesn't matter. They were just, and that's even if they're acknowledged as being there. One of the big points of Israelism, the documentary, which you should definitely go and watch, is that many people are just told that before European Jews arrived in Palestine, it was just empty space. Well, there might have been a few people just hanging around, but it was primarily empty, which is not true at all. It's like absolutely not true at all. But this is a narrative. This is a fairy tale that is told in order to justify, glorify, like Israeli settlement in this area. Now, in 1948, when nearly 1 million Palestinians lost their, like 1 million people, it's amazing. It's just amazing. You know, unfathomable numbers. And one of the other things that I get told a lot is like, oh, well, why do you care about this issue so much unless you're anti-Semitic, because you don't talk about other issues? Well, firstly, I do. But secondly, what a strange way to justify violence. Like, unless you talk about all violence, you can't talk about violence at all. Which I think is just such a fascinating rhetorical trick. It's like a kind of sophistry. Because, of course, no one can ever talk about everything all at once. That would be an amazing feat. I'd love to see someone do that. But it's also to gatekeep what it means to care. And to gatekeep how people feel responsible for different historical events. Part of the reason there is so much backlash to what has been going on in Israel's unbelievable bombardment of Palestinians and Palestinian territory, which, as of recording now, has killed more than 30,000 civilians, more than 10,000 children, all innocent as confirmed by so many independent organizations like The Lancet, despite, you know, big news networks who just say that it's the Hamas-run health ministry that is giving the numbers. These have been confirmed independently, but in any case, you know, whatever propaganda line is trying to cast doubt about the official report, it's almost like a conspiracy theory. But yes, 30,000. It's a number I can't even fathom. You can just watch videos too. I don't recommend this, of innocent people just being just blown up. Not to mention how the Israeli military killed just a group of its own hostages who were waving white flags, like a sign at how it seems like they're just indiscriminately killing people, or killing people, starving people, wanting food, displacing 2 million since October 7th. And I know that there's a bunch of you listening and you're like, well, this guy's clearly a Hamas supporter. He hasn't condemned Hamas at all. Why? How could he go 16, 17 minutes without having condemned Hamas? I mean, how can we possibly take this guy seriously if he's not willing to condemn Hamas? A very common refrain. And I will always condemn Hamas for that. I think that it was absolutely horrendous, and the trauma that inflicted on people is absolutely horrible. But what I often like to do, because I've been asked this many times to say if I condemn Hamas, and I can very easily say that, but I normally follow it up, I can't do that now because no one's talking back with me here, I follow that up with, I will condemn Hamas when you condemn the Israeli occupation, which very few people are willing to do, and I find that very interesting, because apparently, the price for Hamas killing 1,200 Israeli citizens, taking a couple hundred more hostage, apparently the price for that is, as of now, more than 30,000 killed civilians. And through those efforts, through dropping bombs, destroying innumerable homes, displacing 2 million people, more, through all of that, they've only managed to release a handful of hostages through those military efforts. That is the price of what Hamas did. So, I mean, I'm a rationalist. I believe firmly in equality, honesty, and truth. What is then the price of all of the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of displaced people, the tens of thousands of murdered Palestinians way before October 7th. What is the price of that by the Israeli forces? Is there any price to pay for that? Because it seems, I think we have to hold these people both accountable. I mean, we are rational people. We believe in equality. You have two sides here. You have Hamas. You have the Israeli forces. You have Israel. We must hold them both equally accountable. And of course, when we're going to talk a lot about this, this is just kind of the overview. We haven't even talked about the West Bank. So in Palestine, you have Gaza and you have the West Bank. And the West Bank is just under Israeli occupation. And, you know, I don't think people really know what that means a lot of the time. These are people who can't just leave their country. They can't just leave. People in Gaza are living in an open-air prison that has two entry points controlled by Israel. Like, who among us would be okay with that? And the irony to this is, like, all those really, you know, right-leaning type American people who think that if someone steps on their property, they're allowed to kill them, think that Gazans have absolutely no moral ground at all for living in a prison, an open-air prison where they're not allowed to leave. And I find that just very interesting. It just blows my mind. So for all of you who are listening and thinking to yourselves, this guy's not going to condemn Hamas, is he? I did, and I will continue to do it. I'm waiting then for you to write in the comments how you condemn Israel. Make sure it's your name, not some pseudonym, how you condemn Israel, and then we can share it with the world, you know? Because we're just playing on an equal playing field here. Now, there's so much more to this history. The next big event, I would say, would be 1967, with the Six-Day War between Israel and the neighboring Arab states, Lebanon and Syria, Egypt, that resulted in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of more Palestinians, not to even innumerable Palestinian deaths, where all of the neighboring states suffered a brutal loss at the hands of Israel and their supporters in Europe and the U.S. This resulted in Egypt losing the Sinai Peninsula, which will be relevant in Chapter 4 when we talk about Camp David and the efforts Israel and Egypt took for Egypt to regain the Sinai Peninsula and, you know, not be able to not allow Palestinians to actually gain any kind of autonomy in the West Bank, like a lot to this history. But yeah, I mean, it's to me, it's just unfathomable what life is like as a Palestinian, where you can be in Tel Aviv in Israel and people are sitting in cafes, you know, they're living their best cosmopolitan life. And just a few miles away, you know, I'm exaggerating, a few miles away, you have Gaza, where people's access to food is contingent upon Israel's mood that day, whether or not food is actually going to be able to access or enter into Gaza. And this extends way beyond just Israel and Palestine. Like, I've had friends, people I know, not friends of friends, people I know, who've been arrested by the IDF for trying to bring medical supplies into Gaza, arrested and beaten to try to bring medical supplies into Gaza, which is like many years ago. And it amazes me how any kind of discussion of this or what happened on October 7th with Hamas's violent, brutal attack, absolutely horrendous, how any discussion of it seems to only to set that as the beginning of history, as though there was nothing before this, as though Israelis are absolutely justified in using any amount of force they want, killing 30,000 people, but Hamas is not allowed to use any kind of force. And when they do, they're backwards, barbaric, violent, brutal, horrendous people. But when Israelis do it and the IDF does it, then it's righteous. It's to protect democracy. And this all belongs to that broader trajectory of European colonialism and the idea of European superiority. Now, obviously, in the face of all this, because, like, this is such a difficult history to recount. You know, I've edited this and re-said parts of this so many times. It is so difficult to recount this history. And I'm going to be recounting it. More of it's going to unfold as we go through it here. And I want you to know that. So there's going to be many of you listening like, this guy doesn't even talk about all the other acts of Palestinian violence against Israelis. Okay, this guy, are you serious? He's not going to talk about Hebron or the attempted assault on Tel Aviv? Or is he going to talk about Munich in 1972? Yeah, I'm going to talk about all that. Sorry if I'm not giving you the history, like every single detail right away. We're going to talk about so much more of the history. This is just bare bones stuff. And I'm just making it totally plain to see that I think I side with the international community in the United Nations in calling out Israel's occupation of Palestine and Palestinian territory and Palestinians, and alongside the international community in calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza right now, which I have been calling for from day one, knowing full well that Israel's response to October 7th would be disproportionate and it would result in the deaths of, I don't even want to say the number I thought, but like, we have now far eclipsed that, and it's just, it's like an absolutely horrendous display that no one can support, I don't think. Now, one of the other things that Saeed wants to do here is think through the ambiguity of Palestinian identity. And there's so many things to unpack here, because Palestine was only like internationally really recognized as a state in the late 80s, even though it was treated as its own state long before then. But this is part of a broader effort to try and erase the history of Palestinian existence in Palestine before European Jewish settlers arrived. Like I said, of course, there were always Jews there. I mean, Jews have a very long history on that land, as do Arabic Muslim Palestinians. Like, I mean, both of these things can be true. How come, though, one of those people's claims to that land is backed up by, you know, the world's largest superpowers, is used to justify murdering just innumerable Palestinians just to have that land? Now, in the face of this, Palestinians, like, you know, the idea about a Palestinian identity is always ambiguous. And I'm not saying that because there's anything ambiguous about Palestinian identity. It's just that there's, when you're dealing with any group of people, it's hard to just subsume them into a singular homogenous identity. This relates to like Benedict Anderson's idea of the imagined community. And to impose an identity onto these people, which in large part they were forced to do, especially with the establishment of, or Arafat's involved in the establishment of the PLO, like I said, under Arafat, Palestinians were essentially forced to adopt this kind of national identity, to adopt this very Western logic of borders, of nations, of this one homogenous national identity, just to be recognized. They had to do that. And did it get them anywhere? No. It was branded a terrorist group, then it was just used to further encroach on their territory. But there's always going to be some ambiguity when trying to talk about any group's identity. Like, no group has one single identity. Now, there are certainly things that are distinct. Their dialect, their cuisine, a very rich, long history of Palestinian cuisine, of music, of art, culture, and all these other forms. Kefia, for example, worn also by Nelson Mandela to demonstrate his support of Palestinians. Get into the resonances between South African apartheid and Palestinian oppression, and the oppression of Palestinians later. But they share this common bond and this attachment to the land that they call home and that they have for centuries. And they also, I mean, there's so many things that just make up their identity, but like, there isn't like a single homogenous thing. They're just a people. And it's like, they're people. I don't know why, that's just, they're people with dreams and hopes and aspirations, and they're being systematically murdered. And like, every time I think about it, I just can't get beyond this. But like, in the way that people have responded after October 7th, I don't care if Hamas is the worst organization in the world and committed the worst crime. These civilians don't deserve that. And they keep being, you know, one of the common refrains is that, oh, they're human shields. This actually has been used a lot. Israel has often used very similar arguments all throughout their occupation. This isn't new. Way before Hamas that gained power in 2007, Israel was saying very similar stuff. Or how Israel would justify killing civilians, and they have been doing this for nearly a century, more than a century actually, killing civilians because they say, oh, we warned them first. Now it's like they drop leaflets and then they bomb the hell out of it. And they say, oh, well, we warned them. Which is an interesting thing to say, because I wonder if the same argument can be used by Hamas. Like, what if Hamas had warned people about October 7th? Like, 20 minutes before October 7th, dropped some leaflets, and then went in. I guess Israel would be the first to be like, oh, well, they're justified. You know, they warned the people. It's their fault they didn't leave. Right? What's the difference? Like I said, I'm a good rationalist. I believe in equality, equity. I believe very firmly that people should be held all equally accountable for the things that they do. So, I mean, explain to me where I've gone wrong. I'd love to know. And it has to be stated and restated, like, Hamas only gained power in 2007. And since, like, this has been going on for more than, like, 100 years. And it's like, I can't even, it blows my mind. And it's so ironic because you even see people today, there's like ding-dong celebrities out there supporting Israel who are like, what is Palestine? It's not even a place. It's like, it's not even a country yet. Or it doesn't even have any real like political representation, whatever nonsense is being said. But then when it comes to Hamas, then they're super willing to be like, oh yeah, it's a highly structured political organization and every single civilian is complicit. They're all part of this. So, I mean, I'm just asking for consistency here. I mean, this is an unbelievable double standard. This is unbelievable hypocrisy where on the one hand, Palestinian lack of political stability or lack of political representation is used to justify their being eradicated. But on the other hand, it's then, you know, they're made hyper-political in being reduced to Hamas, which is then also used to justify eradicating them. It's a very clever trick that produces a situation where no matter route you take, the end solution is to kill as many Palestinians as possible. And the other way, of course, we all know that killing civilians is justified because Hamas uses them as human shields when the number of Hamas operatives and military personnel that have been killed pales in comparison to the number of civilians, which is like, well, it seems as though the human shield narrative is falling apart. But it's also interesting to highlight the way that Israel actually uses human shields, in that Israel is very clever and they make sure to arm people in their settlements, in their illegal settlements in the West Bank and on the neighboring or the bordering towns of Gaza and the West Bank, as the second line of defense against Palestinian retaliation, where the first line of defense is their Iron Dome that stops bombs from entering the territory, entering into their airspace. So, I mean, is this not a kind of... Imagine if a story came out that all Palestinians in the West Bank were armed against illegal Israeli settlements. Do you think Israel would be like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we do that too, cool. I mean, we're all on board with that. Totally awesome. I don't think that's how the narrative would go. I really don't. But if you think otherwise, I'd love to hear about it. Now, the other talking point I hear, the common thing is that, oh well, the violence against Palestinians would end if Hamas releases the hostages. And, oh, okay. Is this a hostage thing? Because if it is, then let's be consistent here. Would it then follow that the hundreds of children currently being held by Israel and that have been held before October 7th, the hundreds of children, not to mention the 4,000 adults, 1,000 of which are not actually given the opportunity to have a trial, how about they release their hostages? Or it's okay because they call them prisoners, even though they can't have a trial or anything. Like, I'm trying desperately to just be consistent here. I'm a good rationalist. I believe firmly in equality and equity. I think that it's interesting that only the issue of hostages is cited against Hamas, but not for Israel, as though Israel has never done that before and does not currently have hostages. And it's also, I think, a good follow-up question is like, what would really end if Hamas gave up the hostages? Which I need to make incredibly clear. I want these people to not be hostages anymore, just like I want the people in Palestinian people in Israel to not be hostages anymore. Both of these things can be true. And I think that this would come about through a sustained effort in establishing a free Palestine, which would result in this situation, which would result in the release of hostages. So I just think it's super interesting that the situation is framed as though Hamas is the only one with hostages, and they're the only ones who can end this right now, when Israel has a lot of tools at their disposal to end this right now. The simplest being to grant Palestine and Palestinians autonomy so that they don't live in an open-air prison, or that they can leave their country as the UN Charter of Human Rights says someone should be allowed to do without being interrogated, where Palestinians have to always have their papers on them or else the IDF is going to arrest them, or how the IDF is just snipes children and adults in the West Bank. So no Hamas, there's no Hamas in the West Bank, just snipes children, drone kills them in the West Bank, innocent people doing nothing wrong, just kills them, or kills them in Lebanon or any other neighboring country where they don't like the people there. I mean, this is what I imagine, is to have a Palestine free from that, that is free and self and is autonomous and is able to determine their own destiny without military involvement, without a military presence from another country. Like, what other country would tolerate this? Because, I mean, the U.S. is totally prepared to back Israel in this effort. Would the U.S. be totally cool if suddenly their borders are closed up and there are two points of entrance? I guess they would. I mean, they're totally cool with doing it to the Palestinians. So, or checkpoints every few miles. I'm sure Americans would love that. Yeah, I mean, and I'm just a rationalist. I just believe in being fair. So why not? Now, before getting into the preface, I want to read a few quotes from the first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion. So see, here are some very important quotes from the first prime minister of Israel. And I quote, "We must do everything to ensure Palestinians never do return." "We must expel the Arabs, take their places." "Politically, we are aggressors, and they defend themselves. The country is theirs because they inhabit it. Behind Arabic terrorism is a movement." So he's justifying it. I mean, he's saying that they are the aggressors. "And finally, we have taken their country. It is true that God promised it to us, but how could that interest them?" He's been promised this. They've been promised this land by God. So they must expel the Palestinians and make sure they never return home. This has been part of the agenda since at least 1948 with the first prime minister, and has been the agenda for much earlier than that. Now we jump into the preface, which I'm sure many of you are frustrated that I haven't gotten to it now. And I'm sure many of you are frustrated at my tone, but it's either this or tears. And I can't find a middle ground, just because to me this situation is just so, I can't understand it. So we start with the preface, which was actually written in 92, so about 15 years after he wrote the book The Question of Palestine, where it has only grown in relevance, and it's actually really it's really sad, because there's a really optimistic tone in Saeed's voice writing this in the early 90s with like the Oslo Accords, and there were, I think, some hope for Palestinians to be able to live a life free of oppression, but that didn't happen, and it's sad. And it's only grown in relevance since then. I mean, the whole book. But yeah. So as he wrote it then, the main aspects of Palestinian life, he says really accurately, at least these are the defining qualities really, are dispossession, exile, dispersion, and disenfranchisement. Now, up to 1977 and afterward, Israel has made two broad captures of Palestinian territory, in 1948 and 1967. Then between 1967 and 83, Israel expropriated more than half of the West Bank. Today, there are 150 illegal settlements in the West Bank. All of this before Hamas's election in 2007. And all of this before Hamas. Like, how many times? I mean, Hamas to me is a drop in the bucket compared to what Israel has inflicted against Palestine and Palestinians. Just the year before Hamas, in 2022, Israel had set up like 9 or 10, you know, don't sue me for getting the number, it's illegal settlements in the West Bank. And it's like, I'm not using this to justify what Hamas did in like a one-to-one ratio, but why is Israel not held accountable for that? They are, like, I mean, it's recognized by the international community and the United Nations, but no one bats an eye for it. Now, the history of Palestinian oppression extends way beyond Israel, too. I mean, the neighboring Arab states have not been historically super kind to Palestinians, like especially Jordan and Lebanon. Like, even if now they've taken on a different stance, historically, there have been a lot of tensions there for many different reasons. And, like, I mean, Palestinians have not always acted in the best way, just as no nation has. But it's just amazing that they, like, despite any other nation doing, like, equally harmful stuff, like, no nation has been subject to such violence. Well, that's not true. Okay, well, let me backpedal. But, like, disproportionate violence compared to the, like, the violence they've committed. Now, through their entire occupation, Palestinians have been forced to be, like, perfect as they can, to follow every rule. Palestinians know that if an IDF soldier shows up, they're scared for their life. Like, they're scared for their life. I've attended quite a few rallies with Jewish Voices for Peace, and there was a previous IDF soldier who gave a testimony about how they left the IDF after watching innocent Palestinians be killed by drones, as they were forced to watch it on the screen and, like, monitor whether or not their bodies would move after, like, the innocent people who were just minding their own business and, like, just, like, in it, watching them die. And this was a moment for this person where they were like, I can't be a part of this. Like, we're just, these people, no trial, nothing, just a drone strike, dead. That's it. And, like, it's unbelievable. And Palestinians know this. They know that the IDF poses an existential threat to them. Like, it's unbelievable. And Palestinians are meant to just accept it. They have to accept it. Any kind of retaliation is construed as terrorism, is called whatever other horrendous stuff, just to justify their further being oppressed. And one of the other things about this is, like, there are people out there who care more about the language that we use to describe Israel's aggression, where they care more about using words like genocide or settler colonialism than they do about the unmeasurable violence that's been inflicted historically and just since October 7th against Palestinians, where they exert more energy policing what language people use than taking death seriously. And it blows my mind. I mean, this has been the whole thing online with I don't even want to mention the clown's name, the people on X, and, you know, it blows my mind why people even care compared to this. I can't believe it. Now, historically, international support for Palestine has been historically faint, partly because so many nations have been scared to support Palestine, because if they did, they'd be called anti-Semitic, as though to support Palestine or to criticize Israel is to be anti-Semitic, which is like, I mean, I study anti-Semitism. I mean, my research is on conspiracy theories. Like, I know the absolute horrors that have been inflicted against Jewish people through anti-Semitism, and anti-Semitism, like, how horrendous it is, and how we're seeing it rise today, how it's affected my friends, how, like, we're seeing synagogues get defaced all throughout the world. We're seeing, like, violence being, like, I'm going to talk about this, like, a whole lot more, but, like, It's horrendous. But for them to equate any criticism of Israel with that, like, it makes it so hard to actually be able to identify the anti-Semitism that's materially threatening Jewish people's lives on a daily basis or drumming up hatred of Jews no matter what. Like, it's scary. Like, that's very scary stuff. And this isn't to say that there isn't anti-Semitism in Palestine. Like, there's anti-Semitism everywhere, and it's a huge problem. Like, Saeed does not ignore, like, histories of Palestinian violence against Israelis, like the first Israeli settlers, too. I mean, you have Hebron, 1929, where, like, although it's unclear, like, how it actually started, 22, 23 Israeli children were killed by Palestinians who were, trying to resist Jewish settlements, and the threat that Jewish settlers were going to go after the Third Temple or Al-Aqsa. And it was absolutely horrendous stuff. And he's totally clear about the way that the violence by hijacking planes in the 1972 Munich Olympics, like the attempted Tel Aviv beach massacre, and of course, he didn't write about October 7th, obviously, but he's totally aware of these things, and they're horrendous. Like, you can't deny that, but to hold them accountable, or it's the disproportionate hatred that is then directed against Palestinians for that, while Israel gets a complete pass, and is you can't question them, you can't criticize them at all, is the problem. I mean, we have to be able to hold both accountable, and to contextualize it, to understand what is going on, to understand that to just criticize Palestinians is to participate in their furthered oppression. And one of the ways that oppression of Palestinians is justified is, like, so many historical events, and even lately, like, I, you know, one of the more recent explanations for Israel's disproportionate response to October 7th, against Palestinians and against Hamas, was that, like, this is a recent thing, like, Netanyahu's old speeches coming out were like, Hitler, what didn't actually want to kill all the Jews, it was only when a Palestinian told him to do it that he suddenly wanted to do it. Which is, like, what a way to diminish the horrors of anti-Semitism in Nazi Germany and the rest of Europe. Like, if you look at the Dreyfus Affair in France, and this is another one of Hannah Arendt's really important points, is that anti-Semitism was rampant in Europe. And there was many people were misguided in thinking that it was just a German thing. Like, no, no, no. I mean, persecution of Jews, long history, we know, all throughout Europe, Russia, Eastern Europe, like, a huge problem. Like, a problem like that, that diminishes the severity of it. But to reduce it, to say that Hitler only did what he did because of Palestinians is the most absurd thing I've ever heard come out of someone's mouth, I think. There's no way I can comprehend it. But many other historical events have been blamed on the Palestinians, like Israel's invasion of Lebanon, or the PLO's attachment to Iraq before Kuwait and the Gulf War were produced by the global community, like their refusal to acknowledge Palestinian sovereignty and self-determination, like forcing them to seek refuge where and with whom they could. And so Palestinians, because they were kicked out of their homes, were forced to make alliances with governments that were hostile to Israel, Lebanon, Egypt. And this created conflict that were then blamed on the Palestinians who were just kicked out of their homes by Israel. Like, you see how it's like self-fulfilling? Like, Israel commits a violence, Zionist settlers commit a violence affecting hundreds of millions of Palestinians, and then they use that to justify oppressing them more. It's mind-boggling. And that puts us here into the introduction. And I promise you, if you want to keep listening to me in the next few episodes, it'll be less about me and I and the things I think. But, like, I'm not the same person since October 7th. I'm not the same person every single day since, in seeing the violence inflicted against Palestinians, seeing what Hamas resorted to. It's horrendous. like to see the amount of suffering is horrendous. I can't make sense of it, but yeah, the introduction written at the time, this book for him was an effort to capture a Palestinian worldview. And like I said, he wrote this in 1977. At the time, like, there was no TikTok with Bissan or Motaz or other Palestinian reporters that people could see. And that, I mean, this has been, if there's any silver lining to have come out of this, the world has seen firsthand what Palestinians live through. They know that Palestinians have been living in a state now of just like being right on the edge of just being absolute, having all their homes destroyed, being displaced, tens of thousands of them being murdered. They are under, like, it's made it plain to see that Israel has had such control over Palestine and Palestinian people that they could do this so quickly, that they could, so many civilians could be murdered, so many homes destroyed, as a sign of like this unequal balance of power. Like, there's no way to compare it. There's no way. And we've been able to see that. So while Palestine and Palestinians share some identity with neighboring Arab states, what sets them apart is certainly their experience of being occupied by Israel. And so, unlike those other states, Palestinians have had to try to work very hard to maintain some kind of an identity in the face of this occupation. And the elephant in the room here is the way that Israel and the West justify Israeli power to defend from Palestinian terrorists, like as though the only way to remedy the situation is to bolster Israel's army, to bolster Israel's military effort, to give them more bombs, more equipment, more tanks to deal with Palestinian terrorists. Now, Saeed chooses not to engage this topic because it's just a means to deflect from Israel's violence, like the topic of Palestinian terrorists. Now, with that being said, we have to talk about it a little bit, because the entire category in the creation of the category of the terrorist serves a very important function in justifying state power. Where, and he's saying this at the time in 1977, he's like, if we just count Israel's violence, the amount of people they've murdered, the number of refugees they've murdered in Lebanon and Jordan, there's no comparison between so-called Palestinian terrorism and Israeli violence. Like, you can't compare them. There's no comparison. So why is it that Israel's violence is completely celebrated by the West's political media class? And why is it celebrated? Meanwhile, Palestinian violence is horribly vilified as this like horrendous acts of brutality that have no logic or reason. Like, as though Israel can do whatever they want to defend themselves. They can kill 30,000 civilians to defend themselves. But, you know, Hamas and Palestine are not allowed at all to defend themselves. Like, why is there this inequality in this way? Ideally, they wouldn't have to defend themselves at all. Ideally, no one would have to die. I mean, that just seems like the obvious thing to me. Now, to demonstrate this, Saeed quotes an interview with then chief of staff of the Israeli army, who says, this is in the 70s, who says that Jordan's population should be punished. Jordan, the civilian population should be punished. And that this is why they don't distinguish civilians from combatants. This was the chief of staff of the Israeli army. And I'm going to read to you so many different passages from previous prime ministers of Israel, key military figures, that just like put it out plain to see how there is this inequality in power and the Israeli view of Palestinians as being subhuman. Their lives are meaningless. And Israel can do whatever they want. Now, let's go back to the terrorist thing. If the definition of a terrorist, as it is a person who uses unlawful violence and intimidation, especially against civilians, then how did this guy's words, how does this not qualify as terrorism? I mean, it fits the criteria, does it not? I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm losing my mind, but it seems like these two things really resonate with one another. So why in this context is this person not considered a terrorist? Like, what is the history of this term called terrorism? Who gets to be called a terrorist? Whereas others are called freedom fighters, or others are called, I don't know, generals, you know? It's wild. Now, the incredible irony here is that much of this violence is done to protect Jews from another potential Holocaust. Now, Hannah Arendt saw through this immediately. Like, Hannah Arendt was in The Origins of Totalitarianism, just like I said before, says that it's absolutely unjust, hypocritical, and ironic that the Jews would then, who move from Europe to Palestine, would then displace nearly a million people. Like, what? And I really don't agree with Hannah Arendt in much of her view about the Holocaust. Like, she victim blames the Jews for the Holocaust, especially when she writes about the scapegoat. In The Scapegoat, in The Origins of Totalitarianism, or when she talks about that, she's like, the problem with thinking about the scapegoat is that it removes the victim of any responsibility. And that sounds like very much like, you know, the Jews were kind of responsible for the Holocaust. And she just says that, like, pretty much. And if you go and listen to the episodes I've done on The Origins of Totalitarianism, you'll know I say it, like, I feel really uncomfortable with this. But I think some other elements are really important to consider and to take seriously, in that Zionism is an extension of European logics of colonialism. And so it's like it's used in a way, or justified through a kind of scientific eugenic principle, where Arabic people are associated with being backwards and undeveloped, whereas European Jews moving to Palestine are these enlightened European thinkers, which resonates with Edward Said's idea of Orientalism in his book, Orientalism. So if you want more on that, you can go and listen to those episodes as well. Funny controversy about that in those episodes, where I misspoke in saying that Turkey is very much, like, my point was to say that it's very much framed as Oriental, even though it has, like, an attachment with Europe. Whereas I said Arabic, and that was big boo-boo. But in any case, you can go check out those episodes to get a better understanding of Said's notion of Orientalism and how the other, the so-called Oriental other, referring to the related to the Muslim world, is used as like a counterpoint to European exceptionalism, where there isn't really an identity acknowledged among Arabic-speaking people in the Muslim world. It's just that they are branded as being other to Europe, and therefore being other to European ideas of enlightenment, of progress, of civilization. And we see the same thing on display here in how Arabic people or Palestinians are viewed in this way. Now, it's such an unradical idea, but at the core of this, Said is saying that people deserve rights. And this is another idea from Hannah Arendt, that the thing that makes a citizen or person a person, is the right to have rights. People deserve that. And it seems unradical to me at all. And it's surprisingly uncommon belief today. Now, the reality is that most of us in the West have sat idly by as Palestinians lost their homes, have been murdered, and Gazans were placed in an open-air prison, all while, you know, we didn't, you know, many of us may have even known about it and just not done anything. I'm certainly culpable. Maybe I'll just speak for myself. I'm culpable. I'm culpable for not being more vocal about it and doing what I can. But in the face of this, I mean, I think it's just such a testament to the Palestinian spirit to be able to persevere. Like, during this occupation, to have built their own, like, national identity, to be recognized in the national community as being a nation of people deserving rights, all while being occupied. Like, what a feat, and what a testament to that spirit and to those people. Yeah, and that'll bring us to chapter one, the question of Palestine. And, I don't know what kind of response there will be to this. I don't know if I was able to deliver something coherent or something you can listen to and actually maybe learn from. I'm sure you know about this all already. I don't know if there'll be backlash. There might. I mean, I can't not present a book like this, but and talk about this. But if there's anything I omitted, and like I said, we're going to cover so much more of the history over the next few episodes. I just couldn't highlight all of it. If there's anything I omitted that I really shouldn't have, you can let me know. I'd love to hear about it. Or anything I got wrong, I'd love to hear about it. And yeah, I'd just love to know what you have to say, because it's a problem that's not going away, and it's something we have to deal with immediately. But yeah, on that note, take care.